Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, you will safely be traveling with us. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or working on your favorite project, you're about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. Got a lot in the news today. We have a special blog from my favorite inverted alchemist, David Martin. We understand one of our archives with David, our Stan Dale, ran after James Gilliland's program Saturday night. Thank you all for the great response. And we're glad you're here with us on a Sunday evening. So much going on. We don't want you to miss a bit. The solar wind tonight is 409 kilometers per second, and there are 6 sunspot clusters on the sun. The proton count is rather high at 2.9 per cubic centimeter. Several important dates are approaching. 2 days from now, on March 5th, comet Pan-STARRS makes its closest approach to Earth. Just a little bit over 1 astronomical unit. That's about 93.5 million miles. Followed on March 10th by its closest approach to the Sun. About 0.3 astronomical units. And boy, will that be a show. As comet Pan-STARRS passes the Sun, solar glare will make it difficult to see as the nucleus vaporizes and brightens. By March 12th and 13th, the comet will reappear in the sunset skies of the northern hemisphere, not far from the crescent moon. You might want to think photo op. It's easy to see. Something unexpected is happening on the sun. 2013 is supposed to be the year of solar maximum. But solar activity is lower than expected, as you have heard on just about every broadcast out there. At least one leading forecaster expects the sun to rebound with a double peaked maximum later this year. Now, that is something nobody really planned for. Heliophysicists are all confused about this. Comet Pan-STARRS, now visible in the southern hemisphere, is brightening as it plunges toward the sun. Despite lingering evening twilight and the glare from a nearly full moon, it's a third magnitude object with a fine orange dust tail visible with binoculars and small telescopes. I have told you I've got some plans here for a binocular holder that will mount to a typical office chair. So you can set your office chair out there, you know, in your driveway or your backyard with this contraption made of PVC pipe and some Velcro strapping. You could put your binoculars on it, and then you don't have to hold them. You can just lay back in the chair with something warm to drink or something cold to drink and put your eyes up to the binoculars and look for hours. It's not very often you get to see a comet. We're going to get to see 2 this year. Pan-STARRS is a long way from us, but still visible. And comet Ison is coming in November. So if you don't have your binocular holder now, you might want to build it by then. Just write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I'll be happy to send you the plans. You can build it in an afternoon with your son. It would make a great scouting project. It's very cool to watch. Also, please don't forget to visit our sponsors. And by the way, thank you very much for updating your subscriptions at X Squared Radio, x2-radio.com. That's how we keep the lights on. That's how we make sure that we get to stay on bbsradio.com. You know, the airtime is not free, even though it is free press. It isn't free airtime. And we definitely want our magnificent and magnanimous producers in Paradise, California, to be able to keep their lights on, and that way you get the great content from us and James Gilliland and other great hosts on BBS Radio Channel 1 and Channel 2. And one of those affiliates is the Food Investor. Sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. There's lots of things that you can invest in, and there are lots of things competing for your dollars right now. But if you really want to send an Easter gift to your grandkids or your kids or to those for whom you care very much, I would send them to the Food Investor, or I would make a purchase on their behalf at the Food Investor and have it shipped to their house. Let me tell you a little bit about what they have. This is gourmet food. It's not, you know, rice and beans and something dehydrated and flavorless or pasty and loaded with carbohydrates and preservatives like an MRE. In fact, there are no preservatives in this food. It's tasty, it's lightweight, and it will last for 30 years in the packaging in which it arrives. It's like a set-it-and-forget-it food storage program. Buy the food, put it in a backpack by the door, and you're good to go. And so will those be for whom you make the purchase. I'm sure you have full faith in FEMA to take care of your every need. But if you've watched the news, and we've had Katrina in 2005, and we've had recently Sandy in New Jersey, and we've seen what a brilliant, stellar job FEMA did in taking care of everybody. Frankly, they don't have enough resources, they don't have enough people, they don't have enough planning, and why would you want to burden them when you're listening to this program and you can take care of yourself? Just go to the Food Investor. Click on the link right on the right-hand side at X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and contact my friends Scott and Danny out in Utah, and they will fix you up with very high quality food. Several of my listeners have taken advantage of this and made substantial purchases, and now they're good to go. Really, they're good to go. I know you could go to your local grocery and you could stock up on canned goods, and you could get 100-pound bags of pinto beans, and you could have barrels of red winter wheat. I know that. I've done that. But you won't be good to go. You'll be good to stay. And if you're going to stay, I suppose that's fine. But if you're going to go, you're going to need something lighter. You're going to need something that you can trade, like a nice foil envelope with a meal for three or three meals for one for a day. You could trade that like money. That's why they call it the Food Investor, so check it out. Also, I want to give a shout-out to my friends Chris and Sherry at the Truth Frequency Network. They're rebroadcasting X Squared Radio each week for a couple of hours. I am a truth freak, and I enjoy being on their program. You might want to check it out as well. I also want to begin what will be about 7 months of promotion for an event that took place last year in Holland, in Hilversum, Holland, and is going to take place this year, thankfully so, in Boulder, Colorado, and that is the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. And there is a link at X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com to the BEM, the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. If you click on that, you'll find out what we did last year in I believe it was early December, and what we're going to do again this year, only on a much bigger scale, in October in Boulder, Colorado. And that is to bring literally the breakthrough energy technology to you. It's something you can purchase. It's something you can build on your own. It's something you can incorporate into your home, your apartment, your office, your automobile, and you can learn to live within the clean energy set of planet Earth without being connected to the grid. All right, phone lines are open all night tonight. The phone numbers are 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. If you're not in North America, you're anywhere else, on planet or off planet, and you can get to a cell phone tower. You can reach us at 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537, or if you're going to be out and about, you can reach us, or listen to us by cell phone, by dialing 805-399-1000. That's our conference line, 805-399-1000, and then putting in the passcode 769-608-POUND. Now, if you want to do this as a speed dial, so that if you're out and about, you find it's the hours between 8 and 11 Eastern time or 5 to 8 Pacific time, and you're not at your computer, but you want to listen anyway while you're driving or walking around or shopping, you can put this on speed dial. It's so simple. Just put us in as a contact, X Squared Radio. Put in 805-399-1000. Then comma, or if you have an iPhone, a lower left-hand corner, you can press the multi-level key. It has the plus, the pound, and the minus sign. And hit pause twice, comma. And then 769-608-pound, and then save that. Now, when time comes for the program to start, you could just hit the speed dial. It will dial the number. When it comes time to put passcode in, it will wait 10 seconds, and then it will put the passcode in for you, and you'll be in. So one touch. And if you have an Android phone, you're in great luck because there's already an app that you can download at x2-radio.com on the left-hand side. Just click on that. If you have an Android phone, boom, one click. And you're into Channel 2 at bbsradio.com. How about that? Do you remember the movie Jurassic Park? I mean, who can forget it? Come on. It was where CG met, you know, kids' movies, and it was a white-knuckle ride, all the movies were. Well, speaking from the prestigious TED conference in Long Beach Wednesday, Sausalito activist Stuart Brand said scientists are developing the ability to reassemble an extinct animal's genome and even recreate the animal itself. I'm not kidding. This is not the movies. This is science fiction becoming science reality. Brand, who gained fame after he campaigned to have the original NASA space photos of Earth published and subsequently created the Whole Earth catalog, you're familiar with that, said Wednesday that de-extinction could be used to help restore organisms and habitats damaged by human activity, according to a report in the Marin Independent Journal. A team of Harvard geneticists, wouldn't you know, are currently working to bring back the passenger pigeon, which has been extinct since 1914, according to the TED website. The passenger pigeon is considered a keystone species because it aided the survival of the buffalo, according to TED. Researchers believe it may now be possible to alter the genetic makeup of a close relative, the band-tailed pigeon, to re-engineer the passenger pigeon. The Jurassic Park-like science was already used to recreate an extinct variety of wild mountain goat in 2010, but the animal died after just minutes due to a lung defect, reports TED. I'm sure they will try that again. Brand said he hopes advancements in the field will help reverse some of the damage done to Earth by us. It could be this is part of the Agenda 21, but the jury's still out as far as I'm concerned. Agenda 21 is an effort to rewild America, to remove humans forever from the wilderness and pack us into mega cities where we will have our habitat and they will have their habitat and the two shall not mix. Brand said humans have made a huge hole in nature in the last 10,000 years. We have the ability now and maybe the moral obligation to repair some of the damage. Brand was one of 50 speakers at this week's conference. Videos from their events have generated a huge online following for TED, which stands for Technology Entertainment Design. Also in the news, I think you've heard this already, but maybe from a different angle. Astronomers studying an unusual black hole system have spotted a never-before-seen structure in the disk of matter encircling the system. It's not what you think. SWIFT J1357.2, an X-ray binary system that regularly emits outbursts of high energy, consists of a black hole slowly consuming its companion star. Matter from the doomed star falls into the accretion disk, which surrounds the black hole, feeding it dust and gas, never to return to this universe. Not as far as we're concerned. While observing the system, a team of scientists noticed an unusual vertical feature traveling through the material. It's the first time we can resolve such a structure in an accretion disk, and it might be ubiquitous in X-ray binaries during the outburst state. Jesus Corral Santana, the Astrophysical Institute of the Canary Islands in Spain, told space.com. The black hole contained is one of the millions of stellar black holes that dot the Milky Way galaxy, or so we suppose. We have not actually been able to get a signal directly from the black hole. The signal that is emitted from black holes, and I know that kind of sounds like also an oxymoron, are gravity waves. As you know, light and radio waves and all these things cannot escape a black hole because of its tremendous amount of mass packed into a very small area, creating an event horizon past which these things cannot pass. But as these black holes revolve in space, they ripple space-time, and those ripples are gravitational waves that can be detected. Two gravitational wave observatories are in the United States, one in Hanover, Washington, the other in Livingston, Louisiana. I have visited both. The pictures of those are on my website at x2-radio.com. If you can make your way to Phoenix Science Foundation, and I'd be happy to share those with you if you want to see them. They're quite spectacular. There's structures that you don't see around. But effectively, these are giant Michelson-Morley interferometers. They're like giant laser framing squares laid out on the ground. And what they do is the laser beams will actually warp as gravitational waves come through space-time. Now, the idea, of course, is to have both observatories running at the same time so that you get some kind of parallax, being that one is up in the northwest and one is down in the south, and thus be able to, by triangulation, locate these black holes in space. Such has not been the case. When the one in Hanover is running, the one in Livingston isn't running. It takes a tremendous amount of money, about $10 million a year, to run these facilities, and it's not been too smooth. Lots of technical hurdles, different things that bother it, vibrations in the earth, crashing waves, high winds. They just make vibrations ever so subtle that do pass through the structure to the mirrors that hang from very fine wires with heavy weights so that they're not supposed to be bothered by such things, but they are. When they're both running, however, they are able to tune out the local effects, such as heavy trucks driving by and earth tremors, etc., lightning or thunder, as it were, and tune those out because obviously those local effects don't occur simultaneously at both locations, and thus be able to only look at the stellar effects, or in this case, the effects left by rotating black holes in space. It's one of those kinds of things where both observatories have to be working perfectly in order for it to function, and it just hasn't happened yet. Both, of course, are government facilities run by taxpayer funds. They are operated by Caltech University, and I've met the PhDs that run both facilities. They were invented by a man named Dr. Kip Thorne, wrote a book called Black Holes and Time Warps. Awesome book. If you're into reading 1,000-page books on physics, you would love it. And the man that runs the Livingston facility is named Dr. Kip Thorne, but not the same Dr. Kip Thorne. Very, very energetic PhD in computer technology. And the one that runs the one in Hanover, Washington is Dr. Fred Raab. That's R-A-A-B, not R-O-B. And he's also very energetic and very open-minded. And if you get a chance to visit either one of these facilities, they're free to visit. You paid for them. Go take a day trip and check it out. You'll really, really like it. Well, this particular black hole, J1357.2, is about three times as massive as the sun. The behemoth likely formed when a single star collapsed inward on itself. This is, by the way, about as small of a sun as can form a black hole. Suns our size don't have enough mass to form a black hole. It takes a sun about 3 to 5 times minimum the size of our sun to begin the process, to lose the battle against its desire to explode out into space like a fusion explosion, a giant hydrogen bomb. It loses the battle with gravity and eventually collapses in on itself. Anyway, the resulting city-sized body packed a great deal of mass into a tiny package, creating a strong gravitational pull on nearby dust and gas. Located in the Virgo constellation, approximately 4,900 light years from Earth, yes, we are safe here. This black hole also contains a small companion star, which has only a quarter the mass of the sun. This companion star orbits the pair's center of mass every 2.8 hours. Now, that's a fast orbit. It's one of the shortest known orbitable periods for such systems. The black hole pulls material from the companion star into its accretion disk, occasionally emitting X-ray bursts that enable scientists to find this otherwise hard-to-spot system. If that companion star was not there, the black hole would be invisible. That is until the two laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories, LIGO for short, actually I call them LIGO, much to the consternation of the people that run the darn things. Anyway, Corral Santan and his team took hundreds of optical images of the system using the Isaac Newton and the William Herschel telescopes, both of which are in the Canary Islands, studying the light produced by the accretion disk. The researchers noticed a periodic dimming in the system, sometimes occurring over the course of only a few seconds, and you know what that means. Since the orbital period of the system is 2.8 hours, those dips cannot be produced by the eclipses of the companion star. Oh no, they are much faster, Corral Santana said. Therefore, they must be produced by a hidden structure placed very close to the black hole in the inner accretion disk. The new find can only be seen in the outer optical portion of the accretion disk, not on the inside where X-ray bursts originate. The X-ray emission, which shows no periodic variation unlike its optical counterpart, indicated a vertical structure was hiding the black hole. Rather than appearing at a set predictable time, the structure shows up over a steadily increasing period, indicating a wave-like movement through the accretion disk. It's a wave produced in the accretion disk, moving outward, like the wave produced when a stone drops in a calm water. The wave-like feature also provides information about the orientation of the black hole, because it's not perfectly round, you know. It used to be thought that it was. Clerk Maxwell thought that they were round. There were several papers written along the theme called Black Holes Have No Hair. It meant that there was no structure. There was no mountains, valleys, etc. on the outside of a black hole, that the gravity was uniform. And from an algebraic point of view, they made their case. But in reality, what we find is as these massive objects spin, they have a tendency to flatten out. And by the way, black holes always spin at their maximum possible speed. It's to conserve momentum. And as they consume mass, the surface area of the black hole increases proportionally. And the rate of revolution on its axis also can increase because of increased energy in the set. So these things can actually get to where they're revolving at 3,000 times a second. Oh, yeah. That's really, really fast. Really fast. And it creates a frequency, something that you can pick up as far as gravitational waves. What we do normally is we look at these things with radio telescopes. That's the two telescopes that were just mentioned. We can pick up the waves. What we would like to do is pick them up with the interferometer. And we're getting there. We're getting there. The electronics have been made quieter. The wave stability of the lasers themselves has been improved several thousand times, many, many orders of magnitude. And this has made the ability to listen to noise outside the variation of the system easier. Now, objects in space face Earth at a variety of angles, or what we call inclinations. You notice that when you look at Saturn with a pair of binoculars or a good telescope, you can see. They can be seen edge on, face on, or, of course, somewhere in between. Swift, J1357.2, is the only one of 50 suspected similar black hole systems found with an edge-on accretion disk, what scientists call a high inclination. However, astronomers think approximately 20% of these systems should provide such a perspective. In order to see the wave-like structure in the accretion disk, scientists must have this edge-on view of the disk, or one very close to it. Flat-on, you're not going to see it. A view from a lower inclination closer to face-on would not reveal the sudden rises and falls in the total light coming out of the system. This black hole is the perfect setup. Because it's the first such system to allow such an edge-on view, the presence of the vertical structure takes on an added significance. No signs of such structures appear in other similar systems, but it could be just because they're not at the right angle. They may all have it, but right now it's just a theory and not enough information to prove it. Now, that is pretty remarkable. We learn a lot about black holes by doing this. Now, the giant amounts of radiation the Van Allen belts generate can pose serious risks for satellites. We already know that. In fact, there were a lot of speculations that astronauts might never be able to leave Earth to go to the moon or anywhere else for that matter, because traveling through the Van Allen radiation belts would be fatal. Obviously, traveling at the speeds that they do when they leave Earth's orbit, somewhere around 20 to 25,000 miles an hour, excuse me. Good grapefruit juice. They weren't exposed long enough. And even though they're traveling in aluminum cans, which are about like cellophane compared to these particles. They go right through it. The astronauts were not exposed to anything that hurt them. Obviously, astronauts are all dying of old age and not with any undue strange growths in their body, which might be brought on by high radiation. So not to worry. To learn more about them, NASA launched twin spacecraft, the Van Allen probes, last year in the summer of 2012, about 7 months ago. The satellites were armed with a host of sensors to thoroughly analyze the plasma, that's energetic particles, magnetic fields and plasma waves in these belts with unprecedented sensitivity and resolution. Now, the identical radiation belt storm probes will follow similar orbits that take them through both the inner and outer radiation belts. The high elliptical orbits range from a minimum altitude of approximately 373 miles to a maximum of about 23,000 miles, about where our GPS satellites and TV satellites are stuck. The unexpectedly, though, while they're taking their measurements, the probes revealed a new radiation belt surrounding Earth, a third one, made of super high energy electrons embedded in the outer Van Allen belt about 11,900 to 13,900 miles. Now, this is a thin, very high energy belt above the planet's surface. The stable ring of space radiation apparently formed on September 2nd and lasted for more than 4 weeks. Now, we don't really know what made it form. We don't really know how often they form, if they're regular, if this is something special. I personally believe it's related to the Earth and the solar system passing through the galactic plane. These kinds of frequencies, these kinds of high energy electrons, super high energy electrons, are exactly what you would expect to find in a gravitational stream of very tight, high frequency waves that are generated from the center of the Milky Way. We're going to talk about what effects these high frequency and high energy electrons may have on our set of energy in our planet in just a little bit. But this feature was so surprising that I initially foolishly thought the instruments on the probes weren't working properly. But I soon realized the lab had built such wonderful instruments that there wasn't anything wrong with them at all. What they saw is what they got. This newfound radiation belt then abruptly and almost completely disappeared on October 2nd. Here on September 2nd, gone on October 1st. It was apparently disrupted by an interplanetary shockwave caused by a spike in solar wind speeds. Or so they thought. Maybe it was a spike in galactic wind speeds. You know, the solar wind has been barely a breeze for a long time. And if the solar wind is not very strong, a stronger wind coming from outside the heliosphere can go right through it and make it all the way to the planets in the solar system. Now, you know, people, we're out here, way out here on the front edge. This is where textbooks are of the future are being written. You're not going to read this in your textbook. You're not going to hear this during your PhD studies and getting ready to make your dissertation. Your professors don't know anything about this. They didn't read about it. They don't know it. They can't teach it. This is way out there on the front of the wave. So stay on the board with me here. More than 5 decades after the original discovery of the original radiation belts, the two that we all know about, you can still find new unexpected things out there. And this is one of them. Now, we don't know what it means, but I can speculate. And professionally, I can do that, and I'm going to do it right here, right now, on X Squared Radio. The phone lines are open, so if this is stimulating any thought in you, if you are a light worker, if you're a amateur astronomer or a thinker of how biological systems, and by that I simply mean the molecular biology that makes up the transducer that houses our spirit temporarily while we're here on this planet. All the DNA, all the molecules, all the energy, the actual third dimensional energy that makes up our bodies, interacts with the galactic energies and the solar energies that we're being exposed to. And nobody in this community, no solar physicist or heliophysicist is going to admit that things are status quo. They're going to say that the reason my field is so exciting, that is because everything is changing every day. Every textbook is being thrown out the window every day and being rewritten. These theories exist only in chalk. They exist only in dry erase on the whiteboards. That's how new they are. However, those of you who have been doing thinking in these areas, have been doing meditating in these areas, have received downloads in these areas, might know something they don't. In the scriptures, it used to be said the Spirit of the Lord would pour out upon the earth, and those who were in tune with that frequency, shall we say, or that energy, would pick up on that and would interpret it based on their own personalities, handed down from eons of experience, their own set of knowledge, which they learned in their schools or in their environment, and they would then be able to condense that Spirit of the Lord into something that they could use in their particular communities. Now, let me be more specific. Musicians will be inspired to write music. Poets will be inspired to write poetry. Prophets will be inspired to write prophecies. And those who cannot put their finger on it, actually define it or condense it into some kind of work or some kind of product or some kind of creation, just have a feeling, just have an inspiration. Something is ringing in the back of their mind. And for some, this turns into dreams or turns into visions or turns into a healing or a change in their biological system or, you know, for that matter, their spiritual system. And with that change, with that new information, they make new decisions. And we see those changes in society. Because the sociology of the human experience, all of the 7 billion people we have here on the planet, is a microcosm of the consciousness that is available in the universe. And if I'm right, if the dark energy, dark matter, which, as I've often said on this program, could just be exceedingly bright matter or bright energy, we just can't see it because it's not in the third dimension. If it is the subconscious of the universe, and it is exposing us to energy, to thoughts, to vibrations that are resonating with things we have already set up in our environment of our own human body, by our own personalities, then the result is going to be manifested in the sociology of Earth. Because tiny changes made over a broad population are going to have measurable effects on the population of mankind, which mankind is simply our individual consciousnesses housed in individual bodies, all alive at the same time on the planet. That's mankind. We, on the one hand, are, you know, consumers and producers here on this planet, adding to the gross national product of whatever it is that's on this planet, be it pollution or durable goods. But we are also a consciousness signature for this planet. The universe is the sum or the average of all the consciousnesses of all the sentient beings in it. We just happen to be all concentrated on this little blue ball rotating around a main sequence sun on an outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy. There isn't much like us for a lot of light years and a lot in just about every direction. And so we are unique. Our consciousness signature has its effect on the universe. And obviously, the universe is affecting us. We can put instruments into space and we can measure it. We can say, oh, gee, there's a new radiation belt. Oh, it's there. Now it's not. High energy electrons flying out in all directions, concentrated in a thin band around the planet, about 11,000 to 12,000, 13,000 miles out there. That's nothing for an electron of high energy. It can definitely make its way to our atmosphere. It can definitely kick off electrons of other molecules in our own ionosphere, in our own stratosphere, in our own atmosphere. And when those electrons replace themselves by higher energy electrons dropping into lower energy states, replacing those sputtered electrons, those molecules fluoresce or give off another photon. And that photon, sometimes it can be physical, sometimes it can be audible, but every single time it does affect, it does vibrate with other things in our Earth. Those photons are not ignored. They are absorbed. They are absorbed by us. They are absorbed by our DNA, by our tissue. And we are changing. We are evolving because of it. That's my theory, and I'm sticking with it. All right. On August 31st last year, a giant prominence on the sun erupted, sending out particles in a shockwave that traveled near Earth. This event may have been one of the causes of this third radiation belt that appeared around Earth a few days later. A phenomenon that was observed for the very first time with these probes. Now, it remains uncertain how it actually rose, but this could be it. It could be bookended by solar disturbances. I'm maintaining, even though there is the coincidence of this prominence by the sun, excuse me while I take a sip of my lovely grapefruit juice. I maintain that there are galactic shockwaves that are doing exactly the same thing. That somewhere in the spring of 2012, we started to enter into this galactic plane. Here we are in the middle of it, and we do not know how thick this plane is, but we're traveling along at, you know, well over 50 miles a second with our sun through the space. And it won't be here long, I won't say. How long? Won't be here 100 years. Won't be here 10 years. It may only be here 2 years. But we are in it. And anybody that doesn't know how to put all these dots together needs to listen to this broadcast again. You need to send a link to this to your friends. Because we are seeing meteoroids become meteorites in our day. We've had three in just a very short amount of time, and there have been other fireballs that are reported. If we don't get a sonic boom out of them, we don't get a meteorite impact from them, but they are out there nonetheless, and they're appearing all over the place. Guys, this doesn't come from the solar system. I know it's easy to say, oh, yeah, it came from the asteroid belt out there, but these kinds of asteroids are swept out of their orbit by these galactic shockwaves. And the fact that we're forming a belt around the Earth means that the magnetic flux of the Earth is reacting with the flow of Earth through this magnetic belt, and it's creating current flow. That's why the electrons are so high energy. That's why they're concentrated in a belt format. And that's why they only exist during short periods of time. It's because the frequency, the wave pattern of this dense gravitational band that extends out from the supermassive spinning black hole in the center of the galaxy has a very tight amplitude. As we pass into it, the belt forms. We pass out of it, the belt goes away. Now, do these frequently occur? Or did we just happen to get lucky and see a very rare circumstance that happens only once in a while? And what other unusual revelations might come now that we are really looking at them with these modern tools? Do you really think it was a coincidence? You really think that? You really think that we just launched a probe, a set of probes at exactly the right time, and that this belt never occurred before and may not occur since? No, I didn't think so. I didn't think so. Anyway, scientists are detailing their findings February 28th, just a few days ago, in the journal Science. So if you want to get on there and go make your comments, you can. I think you'll have more fun if you make the comments here. So how about giving us a call, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, 530-413-9537. Give us a call. We'll talk about it a little bit. Now, that's the space news. And I maintain that it is having an effect upon us here on this planet. And you're probably feeling that effect. It might explain why you feel the way you feel. It's just a thought. It might not be harp. It might not be somebody just messing with you, okay? It might be something galactic affecting you. All right. This is a 3-hour program, and Easter's coming up, and I know you're going to be busy. You're going to be doing lots of things, and I want to kind of put this in your mind to help you think about things maybe in a non-religious way and a more spiritual way. So in the third hour, I am going to do my own personal Easter story. No, it's not going to be the Linus version. I'm going to put some perspective in there. I'm going to take you on a little trip into Jerusalem in 33 AD. So you might want to stick around for the third hour. I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's something I'm sure, I'm positive. There are things that you will learn in that third hour that you have never heard before. If you think you know the Easter story, you don't. Hang around. There's going to be something new for you there. Now, climate change is something that is being argued all over the planet. Governments are capitalizing on it every way they can. And by that, I mean there are political points to be made, of course. There are monetary points to be made with carbon credits and, you know, carbon footprint being interpreted by one government and another, and it's all about the money and control and government this and regulation that. Occasionally we get into that on this program, but I want to talk about some of the real world effects that are being felt, and not just by us, but by the systems of the planet. One of my favorite things to do in the morning is to listen to a short program. It's about 2 or 3 minutes long every morning at about 6:30 in the morning. Of course, you can grab it anytime after that because it's a YouTube. And it is a person that I would like to call a colleague. He goes by the handle Suspicious Observer. And I think if you go to Suspicious Observer in YouTube and you start listening to his broadcasts, you will agree with me. It is succinct. It is backed up with plenty of data, all of it visual. The audio is crisp and clean, and he does a magnificent job in giving you enough information to set up your day and allow you to prepare yourself. And one of the things that he agrees with me on, and there are many, but this particular is that climate change is manifesting itself in what we call climate extremes. And you've heard me talk about this from time to time on this program and in different presentations that I've made around the country. And that is that the winters are getting colder and the summers are getting hotter. And this is true in the northern and southern hemispheres. You would like to know why governments would like to make hay out of it. But at the end of the day, there are two questions that remain. Number one is, how long and how far will these extremes go? And the second question is, do we have anything to do with it? Does the activities of mankind have anything to do with making these extremes manifest themselves in a way that they do? And I think those are two questions we're going to endeavor to answer throughout the year. And one of the ways we're going to do that is to try to give you some information. One of these is probably the largest biosystem on the planet. It is the largest biosystem on the planet. No, it isn't us. It is the ocean. Okay? The salinity level of the world's rivers, lakes, and oceans has been growing. It's a growing topic in response to global climate change. As NASA's Aquarius instrument has shown previously, seasonal salinity has been on the rise in oceans all around the world. Well, you ask yourself, how can that be? What in the world do we have to do with the salinity of the planet? And that is a great question. Because salinity, the minerals, the salt minerals that are occurring in the sea, it is not what we would typically associate with, you know, man's activities. We don't go dumping salt in the oceans. So what's going on? This year, the picture is no less striking. If you look at the Aquarius instrument images with deep shades of oranges and reds, they fill a large swath of the Atlantic Ocean, both to the north and to the south of the equator. Now, launched on June 10, 2011, this is a really recent probe. The Argentine spacecraft SACD Aquarius was specifically developed to study the salt content of the ocean's surface waters. Why, you might add, why, pray tell, would we launch a satellite to try to look at the salinity of the oceans? I will tell you that question. The answer is that with global warming, climate change, we thought that the ice caps are melting. Well, Earth explorers, the ice caps are fresh water. If we're calving off huge parts of the ice caps, and those ice caps are melting into the water, the salinity should be going down, should it not? I mean, should, if you dump continent-sized chunks of freshwater ice into the salt water and that melts into the water, you should see a drop in salinity. And the worry was that desalinated water holds heat from the sun in a different way than salt water that we typically see in the oceans. And at some point, the ability of the water, the oceans, to hold that energy from the sun, or more importantly, to reflect it or to evaporate it back out into space, is going to be the exacerbation point of the effect of climate change on the Earth. And when we launch these probes, you got to back up a little bit and understand how they get launched in the first place. It's not like they get together in the break room and they say, hey, dudes, let's put a probe out there that like measures the salinity of the oceans. No. Back up way before that. Before that, the universities and engineers that work in these areas, they make up grant proposals. And then they go to Washington. And then they lobby, and they lobby, sometimes for years. And depending on how drastic or how dramatic their case is before the government, oh, we have to do this, not just to create jobs, but to learn something, to measure something, to prove an idea so that we can position ourselves as governments and thus as a race on this planet to survive. This probe was built specifically to study the salt content of the ocean's surface waters so that we could figure out how to survive as a race. We built the probe not to make a point, but to learn what's going on in the oceans. And everybody has a hypothesis, do they not? And we develop experiments or measurement methodologies to gather information to prove or disprove the hypothesis. And variations in ocean salinity, one of the main drivers of ocean circulation, are closely associated with the cycling of freshwater around the world. It's the AR. It's the atmospheric river that flows billions of gallons of fresh water around the planet, rains on our crops, allows them to grow, and allows us to live. Well, the data collected from these measurements provides scientists with valuable information on how global climate change is affecting rainfall patterns around the globe. Now, you can continue to listen to all the politicians and say climate change is a whole bunch of hooey, that these guys are crackpots, that all they're trying to do is get a bunch of tax money out of us, and they're just trying to, you know, keep us from driving our SUVs, darn it. Come on, those nutcases. You really think that? Well, with a bit more than a year of data, just a year. Now, in a planetary cycle, that is like the snap of my fingers in time. It's nothing. We're not talking about geology. We're talking about the hydrology of the planet. We're talking about the bloodstream of Earth. We only have a year of data, and we are seeing some surprising patterns, especially in the Seattle, Washington area. These features are evolving rapidly, and I mean in a matter of weeks and months. Aquarius was designed to cover the Earth from an orbit that takes it all over the world's ice-free oceans. Just one little strip at a time, okay? 240-mile-wide swaths. That's it. It's like the top 1 inch of ocean water. That's all the deeper it can see with its instruments. 240 miles wide. Around and around and around the planet it goes, like a ball of string. By the time it finishes its set of orbits and starts over again, the measurements are different. NASA has now received its first full year worth of data from Aquarius, showing the variation and the varying salinity patterns around the globe. By studying this data, and let me say that's not a simple word. The reason it's not a simple word is because who studies it? It ain't your governor. It's not your senator. It's grad students. You know, they work for slightly less than you make at Taco Bell. Grad students study this data. Grad students make their PhDs by studying this data. And there are research teams all over the planet that are poring over this data. And guess what they can't do? They can't agree. They can't agree. What they see is that the Arabian Sea, which sits against the Middle East, is much saltier than the Bay of Bengal. No duh. Which is diluted by intense monsoons and freshwater discharges from the Ganges River as well as others. And who knows what's pouring into there from the Ganges River. Have you ever seen the Ganges River? Have you ever driven over the Ganges River? Yeah, it's the nastiest smelling thing you ever smelled. Try it sometime. Drive over it in Nepal. Drive over it in India. Drive over it sometime and smell what dumps into that river. All that is going into the Bay of Bengal. The Amazon, which releases large amounts of fresh water into the southern Atlantic, will either send a plume of fresh water toward Africa or bend upward toward the Caribbean, depending on the seasonal currents. Fresh water also builds up against Panama's coast, carried down from the Central Pacific. Some of the most saline-rich regions highlighted by Aquarius would be the Mediterranean Sea and the North Atlantic Ocean. And as for the North Atlantic, it's the saltiest stretch of water on Earth. An expedition launched by NASA, the Salinity Processes in the Upper Ocean Regional Study, also called SPERS, they always have acronyms for things, sent researchers to the North Atlantic last fall to investigate these salt-rich waters and analyze the cause behind the high concentration levels. The expedition was also seen as a move to validate the measurements taken by Aquarius. I told you, you come up with theories, you come up with a hypothesis, you start generating experiments to go gather data to prove or disprove the hypothesis and make a theory. Well, the conclusion after 5 weeks out at sea and analyzing five weekly maps of salinity from Aquarius while they were there was that indeed the patterns of salinity variation seen from Aquarius and the ship were similar. Aquarius was designed to operate for 3 years, measuring the salinity of Earth's precious oceans. Let's see here. Researchers plan to continue to use Aquarius for measuring the salinity of the world's oceans, but wish to fine-tune the readings and retrieve more data even closer to coasts and at the poles. Currently, land and ice emit very bright microwave emissions that block the satellite signal. And at the poles, an added complication is that cold polar waters require much larger changes in salt concentration to modify microwaves and signals. You know, that's how it's done. You beam microwaves down to it and then look at the reflection. That's how they spectrographically measure the saline content. Still, Aquarius has been able to garner close coastal readings, producing valuable data for the NASA researchers, who are surprised to see how close to land those readings actually are. The fact that we're getting areas, particularly around islands in the Pacific, that are not obviously badly contaminated is pretty remarkable. It says that our ability to screen out land contamination seems to be working quite well. It doesn't mean that we're not polluting. It just means they've learned to screen it out. Salinity readings can be further affected by intense rainfall. It does this by attenuating microwave signal Aquarius reads off the ocean surface as it travels through a damp atmosphere. As you know, high humidity conditions are difficult for microwaves to travel through because the 108 degree angle of the water molecule does resonate with the microwave energy and thus absorbs it. Ultimately, the team wants to combine the Aquarius measurements with those of the soil, moisture, and ocean salinity satellite, which is operated by the European Space Agency. The team also is set to release its first global soil moisture data set, which will further complement measurements made by the soil satellite. The first year of the Aquarius mission has mostly been about understanding how the instruments and algorithms are performing. Now that they have overcome the major hurdles, they can really begin to focus on understanding what the data are telling us about how the ocean works, how it affects weather and climate, and what new insights they can gain by having these remarkable salinity measurements. We look for good things out of this. Now, there's some things I want to go into. We'll continue this after the break. But I ran across a song. It's actually it's quite profound. Now, it's not like something that I have played before. So I want to kind of prepare you for this. I don't want to shock you. This is not a song that you can find out there. You can't Google it. You can't search it. I ran across it a number of years ago. It is industrial in its content, musical content. But I wanted to share it with you because I think there are some people out there that would like to hear it. Here are the words. The song is called Fly, and we do not know who it's by. The band may no longer exist, but the recording is pretty good, and the energy is phenomenal. I'm going to play it for you. I may never play it for you again. So you might want to listen closely. Here are the words. Fly. So fly. And fly and fly. Now get back to this place where you came from. Spared your pain. Yeah, it's all fine. Huddled up with your crying. Lonely angels, fly. How can I be so strong and take it all for so long? Then I found out why. Lonely angels can fly. Fly away from here. Can I fly? So fly and fly and fly. Look, can I be so strong like you and feel this pain inside? Open up your eyes. Lonely angels, fly. Look, can I be strong like you and feel this pain inside? Open up your eyes, lonely angels. Well, I can't take it anymore and be a good boy. I'm so bored. Bowed head, closed eyes. Why can't I fly? Oh, I want to be strong. I've been waiting here for so long. Then I found out why. Lonely angels can fly, fly away from here. Here we go. right. That's something that you don't hear every day. I just want to let you know. Let me go ahead and change tapes really quick. Don't go away. Just take me a second here, a couple of clicks, and we'll be ready to go while we listen to a little bit of Thomas Newman. Okay, welcome back to X Squared Radio, Hour 2. We're discussing climate change, climate extremes. What's going on out there? Marvelous, marvelous stuff. There are some things about climate change that we experience with our planet. We don't really know why. We just notice changes. We see a change in the breeze. We see a change in the flowers. Those of you that work the ground, that plant, that farm, deal in food, feed people, you see the difference. You see the cycles changing. The snow lasts a little bit longer. The heat lasts a little bit longer. The rain is not as plentiful as it once was. Different effects, different changes. You can feel it when you touch the soil. You can feel it when you breathe the air. If you sail the oceans, you also can tell something is in the breeze. Something different. Where are we in space? What is our planet being exposed to, and thus we as the beings upon it? In this hour, I want to discuss that in depth with you. Our phone number here, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, it's 530-413-9537. And I encourage you to call in. Discuss with me. Share your thoughts with me. All right. We have several different items here. We're talking about deep sea salt water. You haven't given it a lot of thought, but it's affecting our planet. And it is being affected by the space that our solar system is traveling through right now. In all of the planets on our solar system, this is the only one with liquid water. The water is alive in a sense. It is a remarkable, special molecule with its own power, its own abilities, unique. We thrive on it. We live in it. It flows billions of gallons a minute above us. And many more times that around the planet in the form of seas, which are pumped by a tidal gravity which goes around our planet known as the moon. It creates our tides. Many astronomers believe that a successful planet, a successful biosystem on a planet, needs to have a moon, one moon, that tugs and pulls its ocean around so that this planet will have a heartbeat, slow and giant and powerful, to move rivers of water deep that are cold, shallow that are warm, so that streams of nutrients can flow around the planet and feed the sea life all over it. And that sea life can then feed other life, like us, like the birds, that also carry things around the planet. And we exist as a dynamic biosystem with our planet. Now, there are abysmal circulation dynamics that affect the planet. The upwelling creates this sphere-drip type response in the interior, with upwelling causing poleward flow. This is connected to the localized deep source by the deep western boundary current. Thus, paradoxically, most of the deep gyres appear to flow toward the high latitude sources of deep water. As you know, as you get up toward the high latitudes, the water is very deep. Arctic oceans are about 4,400 meters deep. Along the Atlantic coast, the trenches go as deep as 23,000 feet. The deep upwelling can only be accomplished through diapsonal diffusion of heat downwards. Also, freshwater diffusion must be important. The vertical structure resulting from the upwelling depends on the size of the diapsonal diffusivity. Now, what that means is that the cold water is flowing north, the warm water is flowing back south, and it creates a kind of daisy chain, a kind of river, and it flows pretty fast. The circulation, in addition to this deep expression, keeps life flowing around this planet. It's largely cyclonic in the individual deep basins, and it has been reliable for centuries. Ships sail upon it, whales swim it, and it keeps the water flowing around the planet. The North Atlantic deep water, and by the way, there are five sources. We call it NADW, North Atlantic deep water. They're the Arctic intermediate water. I'm sorry, the Antarctic intermediate water, the Antarctic bottom water, Mediterranean overflow water, Labrador seawater, and Nordic seawater. Two of these are the original southern sources, and the other three are the North Atlantic sources. The deep circulation of the Atlantic involves flow of waters from the southern hemisphere into the North Atlantic. Modification and convection of these waters in the North Atlantic and its adjacent seas, and outflow in a thick, deep layer. This deep layer affects the world's ocean, where it can be tracked through its high salinity signature once the North Atlantic begins to flow. By the way, it's the most saline of all the oceans. The deep layer flowing out of the North Atlantic is also called the North Atlantic deep water, as I said, and it's notable for its vertical salinity maximum, vertical oxygen maximum, and vertical nutrient minima. Now, the interesting thing about this water is we have to wonder, where does the salinity come from? And this is one of the things that we want to measure directly with instruments during the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We realize that there is a source of salinity coming into this water from somewhere. Now, it could be that the bottom of the sea is just one big piece of rock salt. But it could also be that there's a vent in this deep crust. Or should I say deep ocean, maybe thin crust, where water from an undercrust ocean is entering that ocean, and that this may be where this salinity is coming from. It's just an idea. It's just a hypothesis. And one of the things that we notice, you know, most of us are familiar with Old Faithful in Yellowstone National Park. A few times a day, it spouts columns of water as the cavity fills with water, reaches boiling temperature, flashes to steam, and then races to the surface and blows out. A hydrothermal vent is a geyser on the seafloor, and it continuously spews water. Supports a diverse community of organisms, by the way. Tube worms and huge clams are often found near these ocean vents. Eyeless shrimp are found at the vents. The first hydrothermal vent was discovered in 1977. They are... Hang on one second here while I make a little change to my margin so I can see this. Here we go. Okay, now we can see what's in there. Okay. These are mineral rich, but they're also very high temperature. The first one is at about 2,100 meters, the first one that was discovered. That's about 7,000 feet deep, pretty darn deep, in areas of the seafloor spreading along an underwater mountain chain that snakes its way around the globe. So how do hydrothermal events form? That's a good question. We don't know where this deep water comes from, not for sure. Some people think it comes from inside the Earth, from a hollow Earth. And some people think it's just a deep kind of honeycomb process that's several miles, maybe hundreds of miles beneath the crust. In some areas along the mid-ocean ridge, the gigantic mountain range moving apart, creating cracks and crevices in the ocean floor, seawater creeps into these cracks, or rock or magma that lies beneath the Earth's crust. As the water is heated, it rises, seeks a path back out to the surface through the sea floor. As the vent water bursts into the ocean, its temperatures are high, about 400 degrees C. That's about 750 degrees Fahrenheit, obviously way above boiling temperature, about 3 to 4 times that of the boiling temperature of water. Yet this water does not flash to steam because it's so deep. The pressure, if you know Boyle's Law, where you're talking about pressure and temperature and volume, you realize that the pressures are high enough that it's not going to flash to steam. It's going to remain water. So these are called smokers, so-called black smokers are the hottest of the vents. They spew mostly iron and sulfide, which combine to form iron monosulfide. This compound gives the smoker its black color. White smokers release water that is cooler than their cousins and often contains compounds of barium, calcium, etc. And, of course, all these compounds are white, so that's why they appear to be white smokers. Geologists are intrigued by how rapidly these vent chimneys grow, about, 9 meters in 18 months. That's a heck of an anthill. A scientist at the University of Washington has been monitoring the growth of Godzilla, a vent chimney in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Oregon. It reached a height of a 15-story building before it toppled, and it's now actively rebuilding. There are many other reasons why scientists want to learn more about these hydrothermal vents, and so do we. That's why we want to take this expedition. These underwater geysers are believed to play an important role in the ocean's temperature, chemistry, and the circulation patterns. Obviously, at the vent, the mineral concentration is going to be very high, and like all pollution, the solution is dilution. So the further out it gets away from the vent, the less and less the concentration is. But these vents are not isolated. There are many of them around the planet. Scientists are also fascinated by the unusual life that inhabits the vent sites. These creatures who live in darkness, extreme conditions, from bacteria to tube worms, may light the way to the development of new drugs, industrial processes, and other products useful to us all. British scientists have found a remarkable array of creatures, some of them new to science, in one of the most inhospitable regions of the deep sea. In the first ever expedition to explore and take samples from the Dragon Vent in the Southwest Indian Ocean, remotely operated submarines spot yeti crabs, sea cucumbers, and snails living around the boiling column of mineral-rich water that spews out of the sea floor. Dr. John Copley, who's one of the scientists on this team, found a new type of yeti crab, and there are two species described so far. They have very long, hairy arms. Ours have short arms, and their undersides are covered in bristles. They're quite different to the ones that are known from the Pacific, said Copley. This is the first time a Yeti crab has been seen in the Indian Ocean. The team has also found sea cucumbers, vent shrimps, and scaly foot snails. Sea cucumbers have previously only been seen at deep sea vents in the eastern Pacific. This is the first time they've been seen in vents in the Indian Ocean. They're not known from the central Indian or mid-Atlantic vents so far. So why are these popping up? Where are they coming from? We just don't know. We just don't know. Now, is this the source of the salinity that we're talking about that the satellites are picking up? It's hard to say. If the salinity is coming from inside the planet, then it must mean that the inside of the planet is full of very, very salt water. In evolutionary terms, hydrothermal vents were like the islands of the ocean floor, just like the 19th century naturalists that went to the Galapagos and other islands to find species that are different to elsewhere, like sea iguanas and blue-footed boobies, and then use that to understand the patterns of dispersal and evolution. We can use deep sea vents to do the same thing beneath the waves. And who knows, and I'm sure they don't, what they're going to discover. We're fishing deeper and deeper waters, oil and gas is moving deeper into deeper and deeper waters, and now there is mining starting to take place in deeper and deeper waters, lithium and other rare earth minerals. One of the things that we do know about the oceans is that they are younger than the rest of the planet. The sea floor is younger than the rest of the planet. And that's because, as many theorize, I believe, the planet is expanding. And so does my colleague Stan Deo, believes the same thing. And if you look at some of the animations that have been done out there, some of the studies that have been done out there, it makes so much sense when you look at the difference of the age of the seafloors and dry land. And it's significant, okay? Dry land, we know the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. Sorry to say, not 6,000 years old, 4.5 billion years old. That argument is resolved. However, the sea floors, the oldest one measured, is only 70 million years old. Hello? That's a big difference by several orders of magnitude. Well, one anyway. So what we have here is new land being formed by the crust cracking and filling in, cracking and filling in, and it's doing it in the form of the sea floor, which is obviously quite a bit lower than dry land, and that's why the oceans recede from dry land and form seas because of sea level being down by the beach. That makes a lot of sense. It makes so much sense that it really blows people's minds that geologists and planetary core geologists are holding on to old ideas that the Earth is the same size it's always been. They don't understand the flood of Noah. They don't understand how a global flood like that could happen. They don't understand what it means when in Genesis it says, "And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep and divided the waters from the waters." Doesn't that make sense to you? Doesn't it look like continents are dividing the waters from the waters? Doesn't it look like the Earth split open, formed a new crust as the molten components of the inner part of the Earth met with the cold liquid water on the surface of the Earth? One cooled the other. Of course, one warmed the other as well. And formed solid crust. Doesn't that make sense to you? Doesn't it make sense when you look at all the continental shelves, how they fit together like perfect, like a hand and a glove, like everything, like Australia and Europe and Asia and South America, North America, Antarctica? Don't you scratch your head and wonder, why is it all those things fit together so nicely all the way around the planet? It's simple. Just let the air out of the balloon and let it all come back together. And then you can blow it back up to its present size and you can go back and forth and you can see, oh, wow, that does fit together quite nicely. Just apply a little bit of Occam's razor to the balloon idea and see what you get. No, it won't pop. It's a good theory. All right. That's all I want to talk about, climate change and planetary physics. Let's go ahead and do a Wars R Us update. In about a half an hour, by the way, I'm going to start the third hour of X Squared Radio, and I'm going to talk about Easter. It's something that you haven't heard before, I can promise you that. All right. The following audio should wake you up to the threat we face from our own government. This is an interview that Gary Franchi did. He's with WHDN News. And he interviewed Tangerine Bullen about a lawsuit that her team filed against the current administration to protect themselves and you and I, by the way, against unlawful arrest. Okay? I want you to listen to this interview. You will. It's nice and clear. It's self-explanatory. I think you'll get it. You'll see what's going on with this dreaded NDAA.
The NDAA has been called the death of our Republican form of government. That acronym refers to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, which contains a provision allowing the president to order the indefinite military detention of anyone accused of offering substantial support to Al-Qaeda or associated forces. The measure does not define critical terms. For instance, what groups would be considered associated forces? And it applies to U.S. citizens who, under the ambiguous and expansive terms of that measure, could be detained by the military on U.S. soil until what the measure calls the end of hostilities, which in the open-ended war on terror could mean forever. According to the Obama administration spokesman, the NDAA could be used to imprison war correspondents or other journalists who cover terrorism-related issues. The NDAA has no parallel in American history. In fact, it is without precedent in the history of Anglo-Saxon law since the Magna Carta was signed in 2015.
That's 1215.
The closest historical kindred to the NDAA would be Article 58 of the Soviet Criminal Code, which allows for arrest and summary imprisonment of anyone suspected of working to undermine the Soviet state. Journalist and activist Tangerine Bolin is one of eight plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the NDAA. Although she voted for Obama, she describes herself as terrified by the arbitrary powers that the president and his advisors can now exercise in the name of fighting terrorism. Ms. Bolin, we are very grateful that you can join us to discuss this important subject today. Could you introduce to our audience yourself and the other plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the NDAA and explain why you decided to file the suit?
Absolutely. So I'm Tangerine Bolin, and my co-plaintiffs in the suit against the National Defense Authorization Act, and our lawsuit is called Hedges v. Obama. My co-plaintiffs are Chris Hedges, of course, who originally filed the suit, Noam Chomsky, Dan Ellsberg, Icelandic parliamentarian Birgitta Jonsdottir, Kai Wargala, and New York-based journalist Alexa O'Brien. And why did I decide to file this multi-plaintiff suit? I was, terrified of what my government was becoming in the wake of 9/11. And when the NDAA was passed in 2012, there was a provision with a paragraph in it that basically could cover anyone, journalists, advocates, civil liberties advocates, activists, and essentially allow any of us to be indefinitely detained at whim based on secret evidence and by the military. So I felt particularly in danger, and so did my co-plaintiffs, and so they were happy to join suit.
Now, didn't a federal judge issue a permanent injunction against the NDAA several months ago? And if so, how did the matter wind up back in court?
Oh, so yes, we had an astounding win, first in May and then in August. In May, we were granted a temporary injunction while the judge continued to look at the merits of the case. And then in August, she ruled for a permanent injunction against this provision. It's called Section 1021. She actually declared it facially unconstitutional, which is the strongest ruling any judge anywhere could have handed down to us, and agreed with us that it contravened both the First and Fifth Amendments. How it ended up back in court is that despite President Obama issuing a signing statement in January of 2012 saying he didn't really want these powers, within 24 hours, the administration appealed and even went for an emergency stay on our injunction, claiming that irreparable harm would be incurred if they lost these extremely broad, sweeping, and unchecked powers of indefinite detention. So we were just in court on February 6th this year to hear that appeal.
And now in defending the NDAA, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham insisted that it is appropriate to withhold due process protections from U.S. citizens who adhere to the enemy in a time of war. What's wrong with the argument that Senator Graham has?
And there are so many things wrong with that. I'm not sure where to begin. Obviously, we have the United States Constitution, which is one of the strongest civilizing rule of law documents in the history of humanity. There's a reason we abide by the United States Constitution. All people in this nation are granted due process. And no, it's not okay to declare someone either an enemy of the state or a co-belligerent or an associated force or a terrorist without any presenting any evidence or having to present any evidence to anyone, and the military picking them up off the streets and holding them indefinitely where that person has no access to an attorney, to family, to advocate on their behalf. You know, this government seems to see boogeymen in every corner. And while obviously there's legitimate terrorists to worry about, and we want our government to have an array of tools to combat that fact, that doesn't mean we abandon the United States Constitution. So,
well, I want to get into the distinction between enemies and belligerents in a moment, but given the recent memo that was released in talking about the execution of American citizens using drones and the policy around that, and now talk of setting up so-called assassination tribunals, how does that impact the NDAA and the average American?
Well, you know, it's all interrelated. In fact, there are sort of nascent theories circulating that the NDAA is to be used for a number of things, including legalizing these drone assassinations. So, you know, and all of it is part of a larger pattern of this steady and profound erosion of the rule of law itself and perversion of the rule of law. It's sort of shocking because obviously, President Obama is a constitutional lawyer, yet he seems to have no compunction whatsoever about making the rule of law as he sees fit in this ongoing war on terror. And one of the issues with that, I think that is, you know, most astounding and terrifying is that this quote war has no geographic and no temporal boundaries. So in the past, when nation states were at war, there was some end in sight, hopefully. And even if it took years, there was an end in sight. There
were and Tangerine, let me just jump in real quick because there's also no declaration of war been formally voted on.
Right. And so the NDAA actually seems to be a very strategic and effective way for this administration and even the past administration to legalize things that they've been doing that they should not have been doing in the wake of 9/11. We can get into that later because it's a pretty big part of our case and really critical that the public understand what the United States government is trying to do with this law.
Now, in your recent essay describing your lawsuit, you offered a pointed distinction between enemies and belligerents. Why is that distinction so important? And is it possible for a U.S. citizen to be designated a belligerent by merely exercising rights under the First Amendment?
Well, yeah. Under the 2012 NDAA Section 1021, it appears to be quite possible, and that's why we filed suit. There's a difference between a declared enemy of the state, which has been settled in case law, and a co-belligerent or a, quote, associated force providing, quote, substantial support. Those terms are not defined anywhere in case law. They're not defined in the NDAA itself. And they essentially provide for a covered person's definition that is sweeping and unchecked. Anyone could fall under that definition. Is our government going to pick people up off the streets tomorrow because they criticize it? No, probably not. But people like me, who have tried to help Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, Birgitta Jonstadter, who actually produced the collateral murder video that shows U.S. war crimes. That's a different story. I mean, we're a significant threat when we continue to buck the dominant narrative here. And yes, that provision can cover people like us. And in fact, in March of last year, the DOJ attorneys actually refused to state on the record that people like us would not be indefinitely detained for exercising our First Amendment rights.
Tangerine, some defenders of the NDAA insist that the abuses you describe are entirely hypothetical. Is that the case?
Absolutely not. And we seven plaintiffs were all granted standing in this case. That's because not only were we terrified, legitimately so, of this provision, but each of us had, in effect, changed our activities and behavior because of the NDAA. It's interesting because Dan Ellsberg has spoken about it, and you know, he's talked about the warrantless wiretapping, the fact that both administrations are defending wiretapping journalists when they talk to, quote, unquote, terrorists. And, you know, all of us have changed our activities because we know that at least some of the time, some of us are monitored. So we don't feel like we can engage in our First Amendment activities safely at this point. And secondly, you probably know that there's the example of the Yemeni, the journalist who is imprisoned in Yemen. President Obama has made sure that he has remained imprisoned. The administration has accused him of being engaged with terrorists, but it's quite clear, Jeremy Scahill has done amazing investigative work on this. It's quite clear he's reporting about these terrorists. He became embedded with them so that he could really tell the story of what was going on. He provided a platform for people our government considers unsavory, and President Obama has made sure that he remains imprisoned in Yemen.
Now, is there a double standard between journalists like you just spoke of and, for instance, journalists in the past who've actually sat down with Osama bin Laden and interviewed him on national television? You know, what's the difference here?
Well, that's a good question, and that's what we have brought up in court, and that is what the DOJ attorneys refuse to actually answer. They insist on this right to have this enormous gray area that they define for themselves at whim. So, you know, Chris Hedges has traveled the world. He has traveled and interviewed terrorists of all sorts. And, you know, the government has even claimed that war correspondents could be indefinitely detained under the NDAA. So it's, no one knows. And our case is very conservative. We're simply asking the government to define its terms, to abide within the bounds of the U.S. Constitution, and to make sure they're not trampling the First and Fifth Amendments.
Now, indefinite detention is not the only extraordinary power claimed by the president in the name of the war on terror. The case of Anwar al-Awlaki involved a prominent U.S. citizen dissident who wasn't merely detained, he was executed by way of a drone strike. Is the United States becoming a kind of country where summary execution of dissidents is an accepted policy?
Well, I have a bit of a problem with the way you just framed that, because he was technically designated a terrorist, and given his support of jihadist activities, he is less in a gray area. It's a little more black and white with him, but that does not mean that drone assassinations are okay. We have been a paragon of justice, of democracy for a couple hundred years. And for us to turn around and for our president to say that it's fine to assassinate people because they're on a list of people, you know, we call terrorists, you know, I just think that anyone anywhere deserves and needs due process. And if we don't adhere to those standards, I mean, I don't know what would happen. It's very scary.
Now, you and several of your fellow plaintiffs are self-described progressives who are concerned about the ongoing destruction of the Bill of Rights. Have you received any support from conservatives and libertarians who share your concerns about the preservation of the constitutional government?
Absolutely. In fact, there's a transpartisan coalition that backs our lawsuit. We've had about 25 groups file an amicus brief on our behalf. They were all right-leaning and far-right libertarian. And we have a couple, the BORDC, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and 10th Amendment Center, which are libertarian-leaning. They both support us as well. So this is a nonpartisan issue, actually. And anyone who is, you know, willing to look at the facts and the truth of what is happening essentially supports this case.
Now, what do you say to the people that try to frame this into a partisan issue?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think I've been fortunate to not encounter that too much, because anyone who's paying attention doesn't see it as a partisan issue at all. I think One group that did try to frame it sort of partisan in a partisan manner was John McCain and Lindsey Graham actually filed to have argument time in our court case on February 6th. And they were granted that time, which is really strange because they claimed to speak on behalf of the Senate body. And obviously, they don't speak on behalf of my Senator Ron Wyden, who is categorically against indefinite detention. So they may have actually tried to make it nonpartisan. But there are a lot of politics at play here and a lot of power plays. There's the Obama administration working really hard to maintain this radical executive power to assassinate people and indefinitely detain them. And there's Congress trying to wrangle some of that power back from the executive. So here we are at the center of that fight. And all we're trying to do is force our government to abide by the United States Constitution.
Now, in your recent op-ed column, you acknowledged that you've been a supporter of President Obama. Do you have any idea why he and his administration have fought so tenaciously to preserve the NDAA?
Yeah, I have a couple theories on that. And I was a supporter. I did vote for him in 2008. I voted no confidence in 2012. I can't vote for him at this point. But, you know, the Department of Justice in our case has continually, and I believe strategically, tried to conflate two very distinct laws. The 2001 authorization for use of military force, which allowed the Bush administration to go after a very narrow class of people, and it was just those who had participated in the 9/11 attacks or planned them, or members of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Very, very narrow parameters of indefinite detention on that law. I think the 2012 NDAA is essentially a massive retroactive CYA for the fact that both administrations have been applying the AUMF quite broadly, not within those parameters, which would be illegal. So I think Obama has tremendous incentive to allow his Department of Justice to strategically conflate the powers of these two laws, pull the wool over the eyes of everyone, the judiciary, the public, et cetera, and make sure that we don't understand that the government did not have these powers ever, and they've just arbitrarily granted themselves those powers through Congress in 2012. So, and I also think it's a way to go after, a very effective way to go after Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and to prevent any future embarrassments or trouble via cyber whistleblowing platforms.
So there you have it. That is a way to grab a hold of dissenters, of people who are doing investigative reporting, which I think that Julian Assange is. He didn't make any of that stuff up. All he did is release the proof of what had been done, some by our government, some by other governments. But these are secrets that should not be secret. These are crimes that were committed. There were 89,000 people killed, murdered in those documents that Julian Assange had released. Tangerine Bolin is on his defense team and so can be seen by, in certain ways, by the administration to be an enemy of the state. And that, we have to realize that it was Obama himself personally that had the overreaching clause of unconstitutional arrest and incarceration without due process and clear violation of the First, Fifth, and Tenth Amendments. It was then the Obama administration that immediately appealed the judge's summary judgment to keep this power in the White House. Now, you may not see the effects now, but in subsequent years and even subsequent presidents, they will have this power as well. Anyone, and that means anyone, can be arrested and incarcerated or exported to a foreign jail without a trial, without a right to an attorney, or contact with your family or friends. You just disappear. You are gone. When did we, citizens of the United States, become enemies of the state? So, by the way, they have a new feature to the drone. The Predator drones are being fitted with a special camera set. Not only that can see you at night and during the day and in smoke and in clouds, but can also tell if you are armed. Now, if you are armed, which you are legally, constitutionally allowed to be in this country, and you are spotted by a drone, you might be electronically labeled an enemy of the state and taken out. So, lots of stuff happening that we don't want to have happen. Now, as I look around, you know, when I look at the algorithm of the economy, and I'm talking about the global economy, not your local economy, I see a lot of dots, and they're pretty good sized dots. And you know what we do here, what I do here, is I like to draw lines between the dots. And I think I've done a pretty good job with this piece. You probably haven't heard much about it from the mainstream media, but the latest figures released by the privately owned Federal Reserve indicate that America's largest banks saw record cash withdrawals during the first full week of January of this year, just a few weeks ago. As reported by Bloomberg and scant others, account holders withdrew a record $114 billion in just 1 week, which represents the largest one-week withdrawal sum made in America since September 11th, 2001. 9/11. What in the world were people thinking? What happened January 1st that made people do that? Oh, you're going to love this. The data, which accounts for all cash withdrawals made from the nation's 25 largest banks, not all your small banks. I'm not talking about your local hometown banks. These are the 25 nation's largest banks. We call them the top 25. They have reportedly shocked many financial analysts who say they are unsure exactly what sparked this minor bank run. Some have speculated that the December 31st, 2012 expiration of the transaction account guarantee, that's the TAG insurance program, which was designed to protect smaller banks from insolvency, may have played a role in triggering what appears to have been a wave of panic withdrawals. Now, it's interesting that Bloomberg would report this. First of all, why would the TAG insurance program expire? Why are smaller banks not protected from insolvency now? I don't know the answer to that question. But since the bulk of these withdrawals were made at larger banks that were not covered by TAG, the explanation doesn't hold water. Sorry. Another more likely explanation is that Americans are simply unsettled with the current state of the financial system and for all intents and purposes are trying to protect their own assets from insolvency. This is further reinforced by the fact that a similar run on physical gold escalated around the exact same time. You saw it. The price of gold shot through the roof. Well, what surprised analysts is that the withdrawals are from larger banks that were considered, quote, safe, explains a report from allvoices.com about the issue. Expectations were for depositors in small and medium banks to put their money in the larger, bigger banks when the insurance program ended because the larger banks would be more stable, right? They're not going anywhere. Though many so-called experts are reluctant to admit it as a possibility, this ongoing trend of massive withdrawals of Federal Reserve notes and physical metal assets from banks and vaults just might be the people's way of responding to the ominous writing on the wall, which does not appear to spell any type of real recovery for America. People, this is not a slow process. This is something that occurred in a period of 7 days and it has not let up. To the contrary, a perfect storm of attempted gun control legislation, ever-increasing taxes, inflation, reduced wages, job cuts, Obamacare may finally be getting the attention of a critical mass of Americans who for too long have ignored the progressive downfall of the financial system. And my personal opinion of this last paragraph is hooey. Absolute hooey. Yes, there are people that listen to X Squared Radio. Yes, there are people that are taking our advice and withdrawing their money, selling their 401ks, buying silver, buying gold, keeping the cash and the gold at their house. Yes, there are people that are doing that. But this is not responsible for this kind of cash withdrawal. That's dot number two. Here's dot number three. Despite the 6.5% stock market rally over the last 3 months, a handful of billionaires are quietly dumping their American stocks and fast. I didn't say middle-income Americans. I didn't even say successful Americans. I said a handful of billionaires. Warren Buffett, who has been a cheerleader for U.S. stocks for quite some time, is dumping shares at an alarming rate. He recently complained of disappointing performance in dyed-in-the-wool American companies like Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, Kraft Foods. In the latest filing for Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett has been drastically reducing his exposure to stocks that depend on consumer purchasing habits. Why? Berkshire sold roughly 19 million shares of Johnson & Johnson and reduced his overall take in consumer product stocks by 21%. Berkshire Hathaway also sold its entire stake in California-based computer parts supplier Intel. With 70% of the U.S. economy dependent on consumer spending, Buffett's apparent lack of faith in these companies' future prospects is worrisome. And dot number four, Buffett is not alone. Fellow billionaire John Paulson, who made a fortune betting on the subprime mortgage meltdown, is clearing out of U.S. stocks as well. During the second quarter of the year, Paulson's hedge fund, Paulson & Company, dumped 14 million shares of, not a mom-and-pop store, J.P. Morgan Chase. The fund also dumped its entire position in discount retailer Family Dollar and consumer goods maker Sara Lee. Come on now, who doesn't like Sara Lee? Finally, billionaire George Soros recently sold nearly all of his bank stocks, including shares of J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs. Between the three banks, Soros sold more than 1 million shares. Now, I don't know if you know the significance of this, but those banks that were just named, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs, are also the three biggest culprits in naked shorting. That means that they are selling shares they do not own, and then they are releasing negative information about those very same companies, driving the price of those stocks down so they can make money. They don't own the shares. They're just selling them. So why are these billionaires dumping their shares of U.S. companies? Wouldn't you like to know? Dot number five. After all, the stock market is still in the midst of its historic rally. Real estate prices have finally leveled off and for the first time in 5 years are actually rising in many locations. And the unemployment rate seems to have stabilized. It's very likely that these professional investors are aware of specific research that points toward a massive market correction. How much? Dun, dun, dun. 90%. One such person publishing this research is Robert Wiedemer. Now, I don't agree with Robert. I'll tell you where I don't agree with him. Here's what he says. Wiedemer gives proof for his dire predictions in this Shockwave interview. Before you dismiss the possibility of a 90% drop in the stock market as unrealistic, consider Wiedemer's credentials. I'm going to be fair with him. I'm going to be fair with him, but I'm debating him without him being present. In 2006, Wiedemer and a team of economists accurately predicted the collapse of the U.S. housing market. Well, no duh. Any framing contractor could have seen that coming. The equity markets, consumer spending that almost sank the United States. They published their research in the book America's Bubble Economy. Who didn't know this? You knew it. I knew it. Come on, this everybody in America knew. You can't keep inflating the price of houses and keep loaning against them and refinancing and 125% mortgages and blah, 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 and on and on. You can't do that. You can't give people mortgages that don't have the ability to pay. People that don't have jobs, people that don't have job history, people that don't have down payments. They have no skin in the game. You can't do that, because what will happen is these people won't make their payments and the bank will go broke. And when it does, it will pop the the bubble, and that's exactly what happened. Come on, people. Everybody knew this was coming. So do I disagree with him? No. I think he was an opportunist at the time. Now, the chief investment strategist at Standard & Poor's said that Wiedemer's track record demands our attention. And finally, the former CFO of Goldman Sachs said Wiedemer's prescience in his first book lends credence to the new warnings. I think that's all a bunch of advertisement hooey, because you could have listened to this program and learned exactly the same thing. Now, it starts with reckless strategy of the Federal Reserve to print a massive amount of money out of thin air in an attempt to stimulate the economy. You saw it. I saw it. Did you actually think it would work? Well, yeah. Well, of course it would have worked if they delivered the money to your house. It would have stimulated your economy, but that's not what happened. That's not what happened. They fed the money to the world's largest corporations, banks, pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and did it trickle down to you? No. These funds haven't made it into the markets and the economy yet. But it is a mathematical certainty that once the dam breaks and this money passes through the reserves and hits the markets, a different kind of inflation occurs. What do I mean by that? Well, classic inflation is caused by printing money. That's the only way inflation occurs. It makes gold worth more cash. It also makes eggs, bread, milk, and gasoline worth more cash. The currency fabrication occurs in two ways. The easiest is this process called quantitative easing. It means adding ones and zeros to the Federal Reserve accounts from thin air. The more difficult but far more politically valuable method is raising the minimum wage. This action prints larger paychecks, but results in the loss of about 5% of the workforce when it occurs. This wage inflation adds zeros to the value of the market, but it decimates small businesses that rely on entry-level workers. Skilled workers do not earn minimum wage. However, they started at minimum wage and they worked their way up, right? Didn't you? I did. So when the entry level gets a dollar an hour bump, the increase goes all the way up the hourly wage scale to about the $20 per hour range. It adds billions of dollars overnight to the cost of goods sold without an offsetting increase in revenue. Bingo, you have forced layoffs. No investors, let alone billionaires, want to remain in the market when the stocks begin sliding during the sell-off. Okay, you remember by reading in the history books, watching Discovery Channel, History Channel, 1929. You remember, after three massive post-war recessions, the market rebounded, and it rebounded hard, and nobody could lose money. People were margined out the wazoo, big time. 10, 50, 90, 100 times they were margined out buying stocks because stocks were going through the roof. Everything was, okay? But when 1929 happened and the crash occurred, the soup lines formed. You could buy a farm for 50 bucks. You could work then for 75 cents a day and all the potatoes you could carry home. The black and white footage from that era was heart-wrenching. But, and this is dot number six, but it wasn't bad for everybody. 1929 was brilliantly executed. And the right people with the right money out of the market at the right time were able to come back into the market and literally buy the country. It was perfect for them. It was awesome for them. Buffett, Paulson, and Soros are dumping stocks. And they're not alone. Other billionaires around the world are doing the same thing. They decided to cash out ahead of the stampede and leave Main Street investors holding the bag. These publicly traded companies do not have the value their stock price commands. They haven't had for years. They haven't had for about 5 years. The stock market only climbed because these investors were in the market trading the stocks. Now, naked short traders dumped billions of shares each month onto the market for unsuspecting Main Street investors to gobble up like bird seed. The stocks don't exist. They're called phantom shares. They're counterfeit. They're borrowed shares that are never delivered to the buyer. Why? Because the companies to whom the stock should belong, they never got the money from the sale. And the people that are doing the dumping are also spreading public statements that the companies are doomed, which drives the stock price down even further. That's their payday. In a perfect world, that little company goes broke and delists from the market. They never have to deliver the stock. They get to keep all the money and not report their income from these phantom shares because they never owned them. These naked short traders have been successful in doing just that more than 10,000 times in the last 5 years. Is it legal? No. Has there been a single prosecution of any of these vampires killing their hosts? Not one. The Department of Justice is completely absent without leave. The cash flowing back into the current administration from the very largest naked shorters is at an all-time high, and we already named three of them. With no end in sight, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and others are among a dozen institutional sources, and there are twice that many foreign brokers doing exactly the same thing. But Main Street investors don't have to see their investments and retirement accounts decimated for the second time in 5 years. If they listen to this program, when the markets open in the morning, they should be doing exactly the same thing. They should cash out now and buy silver or keep their cash in their own personal safe at home. Last week we talked about the silver accident, and my colleague and good friend David Martin, the Inverted Alchemist. If you want to read his blog, you can go to invertedalchemy.com and read it. Here it is, short and succinct and intellectual. Swedish King Charles X Gustav bears a little responsibility for the U.S. sequester. He gets the nod this week for his innovation derived from the Swedes' logistical nightmare of minting copper coins at par value with silver and gold dollars. Yeah. When you're trying to conquer Northern Europe and pay for a war, you don't want your ships hauling around a bunch of copper, even if you've got it in abundance. So you circulate notes instead. And it's the circulation of notes, or more precisely, the idea of circulation attached to money, that was vital to the king's aspirations and what invites him into my observation today. Remember, we're talking about 16th century. Talar, which is the beginning of the dollar, inexplicably, the other source of inspiration for today's observations comes from Sweden as well, per Olaf Astrand and Bengt Salten. These two gentlemen, together with famous Danes Dr. Johannes Lindhard and Dr. August Krogh, isolated the physiology of circulation with a functional discipline known prior to their work. It turns out that living systems require gas exchange. You know, inbound oxygen, outbound carbon dioxide to function. Lance Armstrong and other inspired Tour de France cheaters notwithstanding, there are limits to this system's function beyond which more doesn't do you a bit of good. How does a conquest-animated 17th century Swedish king, a group of Nordic physiologists, and Lance Armstrong all come together? In a word, It's currency. Now let's think about the mistake we make when we confuse terms and blend disparate meanings for convenience sake, only to add ignorance to our collective system awareness. Currency is not money. It isn't. Money, properly functioning, is a temporary storage unit of value. It is an artifact that says that for a defined period, trading parties agree that they will recognize an artifact that, though in and of itself is likely worthless, like paper, is imbued with representational value that can be held or exchanged to discharge future obligations. In other words, you can pay your bills. Currency, literally from the English term courant, describing something in circulation itself derived from the Latin currentium, describing the bounded flow of a thing, only works in exchange, okay? Whether it is the exercising muscle that can only metabolize 70 milliliters per kilogram per minute, or the circulatable monetary supply, like roughly $12 trillion when we stopped counting in the U.S. around 2011, or there are upper limits in the system beyond which stockpiling actually does not lead to greater wealth, but in fact leads to systemic failure. Close inspection of the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve in the U.S. highlights some of the challenges arising from a blurring of the lexicon of money, currency, and assets. Pay close attention here. While utilitarian impulse, think about Charles X, to issue a circulating currency that is connected to copper and the expanding trade network built by war, seems to work when you control the flow of value within a limited geography. That is to say, money across a trade network. If you detach either the value base or the scope of exchange from the limits, flow stops and stagnation happens. Take a look at, well, it's easy to see in a set of system. Okay? Now, when investors, and I mean people like you with your retirement accounts, your 401ks, your pensions, etc., are advised to keep some money, quote, safe in low-risk assets. The argument supporting this advice is that the assets like U.S. Treasuries are, quote, liquid. In other words, if you need to sell them, there would always be a buyer at or near par value. However, this notion of safe liquidity is an illusion that was exterminated by the current fiscal policy. Injecting illusory money backed by vast amounts of, quote, liquid assets for the inflated purchase of cheap debt actually harms the real asset value of these instruments and inflates the inventory of the same beyond what physiologists call T-max. Now, T-max, or transport maximum, is the concentration of a substance beyond which exposure does not result in an increased transportation or utilization of the substance. Here's the example. In the body, this means that if you can breathe 100% pure oxygen, but your blood simply cannot carry more than its saturation limit, it does you no good. No matter how hard you breathe, no matter how fast you breathe, nothing can happen, nothing more. In economics, this means that the system can exchange a certain volume of assets, after which more cannot be absorbed by or liquidated into the system. In other words, it's like 10,000 people all running for the same exit. Only so many people can go through the door. Somebody is going to die. Bill Gross, PIMCO's notorious investment architect, reported that his fund decreased its holdings of mortgage assets. These usually mean mortgage-backed securities. Like, they'll pool a bunch of mortgages together to make one big $5 million SPV, a special purpose vehicle. And then they'll trade that vehicle. Well, PIMCO decided to dump them. These are assets that should theoretically be cash flow generating, because people make their payments, in favor of more U.S. treasuries, which actually don't cash flow very well. Why did he do this? Because Bill understands the problem of liquidity around risk-free assets. If you're PIMCO with nearly $2 trillion in assets, the volume of assets you hold actually presents its own market risk. Because if you ever had to sell them for redemptions, you would actually dump more supply than the market could buy at par value. And so the volume of your wealth would harm your value. He also knows that the Federal Reserve is not buying real estate and treasuries because it wants to invest, but rather to inflate their balance sheet when, not if, they start selling off these assets. He knows that the pressure to sell will be coming not when they see the maximum investment return opportunities, but rather when they have to release the dam to discharge the gargantuan pool of assets they've acquired. And when that happens, the oversupply of secondary sales around these assets will devalue the assets he holds. That means they will become worth less. Worse still, this could happen coincident with inflation, which would accelerate the devaluation and present fiduciaries like PIMCO and real people like you with large amounts of absolutely worthless paper. Behind this drama is the systemic failure to appreciate the difference between utilitarian wealth and hoarded wealth. Here's the difference. Utilitarian wealth evokes the principle that greatest wealth happens at a saturation point where all needs, demands, and aspirations can be sated without restriction. In other words, that's all you can eat at one sitting. Uncoupled from a sense of interchange and interdependence, hoarded wealth creates the malignant illusion that perpetual more is persistently better. Regrettably, hoarded wealth is also sucked into the monochromatic world of green, where the only surrogate of stored value is that ubiquitous European Nordic innovation known as the dollar. Utilitarian wealth understands that the current values cannot be stored in or denominated by representational currency. Because at the core, utilitarian wealth understands that current is a function of conductivity and flow. If you stymie either, you build up a static load that has nowhere to go. It's nature. And in the end, it won't let you cheat. So follow my advice. Get your stuff together. Very slowly, very carefully, make your way to the exit. Take your cash home. Buy a fair amount of silver because it will go up in value while the dollars you are hoarding at your house go down. And get yourself out of debt as fast as you can. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to do this Easter piece. I think you will enjoy it. I guarantee you're going to learn something you never knew before. We'll be right back after this.
Well,
Welcome back to the third hour of X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. And this hour, I want to bring to you the Easter story. Easter's coming up, and I know you're going to hear all kinds of descriptions and all kinds of opinions and other radio programs talk about this kind of stuff all the time. But I want to try to share something with you that maybe has a different aspect you've never heard before about the Easter story. Jerusalem was a very busy, busy place during Passover in those days. Jesus had returned to Jerusalem from the east, came in through the east gate. We don't really understand what it was that he learned in the east, but we do know that when he arrived after his 3-year mission, this time through the east gate of Jerusalem, that there was a lot of speculation as to why he would come, what he would bring. Some looked forward to it and some feared what he would bring. And it's interesting because the Jews were praying at that time in the temple. You remember when the First Supper occurred. I might get a little emotional doing this. The city was vibrating with all kinds of people that had come from all over the world, pilgrims. And as you remember, there were money changers at the temple who were changing all kinds of foreign script into temple script. And when Jesus came, he threw over the tables and said, my house will not be a den of thieves. So he was definitely making his mark. As the First Supper occurred, the Passover supper had been spread over two evenings because it became impossible to prepare the Paschal supper and spread it to everyone who came to Jerusalem. It was just physically impossible. Most people don't realize this, but there were about 256,000 lambs slaughtered and prepared in the temple manor. And then runners would take these Paschal meals out to, in small quantities, out to all kinds of locations around the city. Because it was just not possible for millions of people to get onto the temple grounds. One such meal was prepared in the upper room, which is where the Last Supper occurred. Several things happened in that event. Jesus washed the feet of the apostles to show that the ultimate leader was the ultimate servant, and also that there was some ordinance being done. You remember that Peter, just in his obstinance and pride, refused at first, and Jesus said, if you don't let me wash your feet, you're going to have no place with me. And so then Peter overreacted and said, okay, well, wash my feet, wash my whole body. I mean, whatever it takes. He's always there. And what the Jews were praying for when Jesus was being arrested, tried, and convicted later on that evening is somewhat surprising. A lot of people don't know this. If these ancient Jewish traditions are correct, and I realize that this is disputed, then what we're about to talk about here is probably going to create for you the ultimate coincidence. According to Jewish tradition, at 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., the Jews in the temple would have been praying for redemption. Look upon our affliction and plead our cause and redeem us speedily for your name's sake. For you are a mighty redeemer. Blessed are you, O Lord, the Redeemer of Israel. That's the seventh benediction. Also, according to Jewish tradition, at 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., the Jews in the temple would have been praying for the forgiveness of sins. Forgive us, O our Father, for we have sinned. Pardon us, O our King, for we have transgressed. For you pardon and forgive. Blessed are you, O Lord, who is merciful and always ready to forgive. The sixth benediction. According to Jewish tradition, at 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., the Jews in the temple would have been praying for the coming of the Messiah. Speedily cause the offspring of your servant David to flourish, and let him be exalted by your saving power, for we wait all day long for your salvation. Blessed are you, O Lord, who causes salvation to flourish. That's the 15th benediction. In fact, according to Jewish tradition, at 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., the Jews in the temple would have been praying for the resurrection of the dead. Sound familiar? So after the supper, and Judas left to perform what some say was the greatest betrayal, and others would say the most difficult instructions Judas ever followed, drove him insane and caused him to take his own life. They went up the hill to Gethsemane. Now, Gethsemane is on a hill that overlooks the city. No lights up there, no habitation up there. Lots of very, very old olive trees. It's a garden. There are two parts to the garden. There's an outer part and there's an inner part. In the outer part, eight of the apostles were told to remain, and three of the apostles, Peter, James, and John, went further in with Jesus to the inner part of the garden. And then Jesus asked the three of them, Peter, James, and John, just stay up here and pray with me for a while. And Jesus went on into the inner part of the garden, and then his prayer began. Or should I say continued, because Jesus was always kind of in a state of prayer, and he realized the import of his arrival in Jerusalem at this time. And as he began to pray, as the many, many Christian traditions record, the sins of the world began to be settled upon him. And as the sins of the world began to be settled upon him, he began to experience intense physical pain. The New Testament records that the pain was so great that he bled a drop of blood through his pores. Some Christian traditions teach that he bled from nearly every pore. Of course, when he came out, that would have meant that his garments would have been drenched in blood, that he would have been red and looked like he'd been sliced up. No comments were made of the kind, either from Peter, James, and John, the other eight apostles, or the arresting party that came up with Judas later. So it's difficult to say how much blood actually came through his pores, but that's beside the point. The point is that as the Savior, as the Lamb of God, he was beginning to take upon him the sins of the world. And it was during this process that he communicated with his Father. And it was during this time that even angels visited him to try to comfort him. But I'm sure it's like, hey, you're doing great. You know, good job. I wish I could help, but you got to kind of go through this by yourself. The movie Jesus Christ Superstar. At that time in my life, I wasn't a very religious person, although I was a pretty spiritual person. To me, the film was the same message at a different beat. In fact, I had quite a spiritual experience when watching and listening to Ted Neely's lyrics of that prayer. And I think you would too if you saw it, no matter who you are. So after some time and sensing some change in, I guess, the consciousness of the mountain and realizing that Judas was on his way, he came out to find the apostles sleeping. Actually, he came out a couple times and woke them up. But come on, just had the Last Supper, walked up the hill. It's quiet, not much going on. And you do it too when you pray. You just give in and you fall asleep sometime on your knees. Coming out of the garden now to where the eight are, then the arresting party came. Judas picks him out of the crowd for the arresting party. They arrest him, take him, try him all night, which is illegal, convict him in their own inner religious courts, and then take him to the governor to have a decision made. Actually, it wasn't the governor. It was the Roman, who was in charge of governing Jerusalem, sort of a mayor, sort of a pro tem. I don't even want to mention his name because it's inconsequential. That man's wife had had a dream the night before about Jesus and had in this dream realized that this man was good and no harm should come to him. And so, like all wives do when they get up and fix their breakfast for their husband, she said, now listen, you might have to encounter this guy today because the priests are going to bring him to you. No harm comes to this man. There's no evil in him. Well, you know, Romans are what they are, and sometimes they listen to their wives and sometimes they don't, and you and I both know what happens if they don't. So he did. And he said, take him to Herod. He's the governor. He's the guy that should make this decision. Now, this wasn't Herod the senior. This was Herod the junior. Herod the senior, who had tried to assassinate Jesus when he was just two, by having all two-year-old boys killed, died of a horrible, could have been a bacterial infection, it's hard to say. They said that he literally burned alive from the inside out. Well, his son survived, and his son was quite brilliant and a master governor, quite built the temple to a glorious state that no one had ever seen before. The city was just spectacular under the rule of Herod. However, Herod was even more bloodthirsty than his father, although he was more into the pomp and circumstance than he was actually beating up the people. He defiled everything rather than suppressed. Jesus simply refused to speak to him at all. And so Herod sent him back. Now back in the hands of the Roman, he has one more chance in local law to get rid of this responsibility. And so he pulls out of prison, for all intents and purposes, a terrorist, Barabbas, hated by the Romans, probably hated by the Jews. He was not a savory person at all, an assassin, a violent, rabble-rousing person. And his tactic was, surely given the choice between freeing this man, who has done nothing but go around and heal people, who hasn't done anything wrong, and this man, who is a thug and a loudmouth and a violent man, they will choose the former. But strategically placed throughout the crowd were Caiaphas's cohorts. And so in classic contagion function, they shouted out Barabbas. And so once they saw that the priests were shouting out Barabbas, the people went along with it, and Barabbas was freed. And this Roman washed his hands of the deal and decided to let the priests conduct what they were going to conduct. So condemned to crucifixion he was. Now, Roman law is, in order to keep terrorism under check, they line the roads leading into Jerusalem from the nether lands out there, nether parts of the land. Some of these people are quite wealthy. Some are warriors, princes, and the like, knights. They line these roads with holes into which they drop crucifixes. And they hang violators or enemies of the state on these crucifixes, usually with ropes and sometimes with nails. Thousands, tens of thousands of people over the years. So that when visitors came, they would realize that the centurions, the 100 Romans that kept law and order in the town, were not to be assaulted. In other words, the penalty was so great that you could keep an entire city under control through a system of public terror, which is exactly what was being used. And in that region has been used to this very day. Nobody wants to get their hands cut off. Nobody wants to hang there until they suffocate. But another rule was, because sometimes, you know, you can create a martyr. You get a bunch of people around a person that's being crucified, and the guy that's crucified sits up and says, hey, listen, I got a cache of weapons down here. Go get me down off this thing. Go take these guys out. There's only 100 of them. It was also against the law for any man to be along that road. Any local man. Only women could mourn. No man could go mourn in front of the cross. If you were caught, you could be killed. That was the rule. Only women. And so Jesus was made to carry his own cross up. Keep in mind that he has been in Gethsemane. He has some of the sins of the world piled upon him, which he's still carrying. He's been up all night in illegal trials, up all day being carried over to Herod, and then back to this public spectacle. Any mortal would have been exhausted, would have been beaten, but not this man. He carried that beam. And when they put the pieces together and nailed him to it, they put two nails in his hands and one nail through the feet. Now, it's important to know this because Jesus was a big man. Reports have him at 5'11", some at 6 feet. That's huge for a Semite. He's a big man. When you nail a person to the palm of the hand, it is a very fleshy support. If you wanted to, and you could stand the pain, you could literally pull the nail through your hand, the palm of your hand, and you could take one arm, or possibly both arms, down, and you could get some relief. Anyway, it wouldn't be good. You don't want anybody falling off the nails once they're put through the palm of the hand. So they have a second nail. It's called the nail in the sure place. And they drive this nail through the seven bones that make up the wrist complex. Now, there's a lot that happens in there. There's a nerve about the size of your little finger that goes through there. There are several tendons that go through there, a la carpal tunnel syndrome. And they drive the nail strategically right through that nerve. Now, you've hit your funny bone, right? Nothing funny about it, I can assure you. That nail through that nerve makes it virtually a showstopper to try to pull yourself up with your arms to get a breath. A nailed person is designed not to live very long. But still he lived. And he said seven things while he was on this cross. While the Roman guards were below and one apostle, one man. Now, didn't I just tell you it's the death penalty? And yet one apostle was there. The first thing that Jesus said from the cross, as he was hanging there, everyone knows this, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He's speaking about the Roman guards. Is he thinking about himself? No. He's thinking about the guards. Listen, I know all this is going to come down. I know you're going to blame. I'm saying forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And then he noticed, of course, on crucifixes that were hanging there with him, there were two thieves, not nailed, but tied. One pled to him, if thou be the Christ, basically get us down off of here. Let's get out of here. And the other thief saying, he is the Christ. But he turned to them and said, truly I say unto you today, you shall be with me in paradise. Because that thief, even though he was hanging on the cross, he wasn't the one that questioned the divinity of the Savior. He was the one that said he is the Christ. Now, Jesus saw his own mother, Mary, and the disciple, which we know to be John, standing near whom he loved. That would be Mary Magdalene. And he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour, he took his mother into his family. It was tradition that when you were going away to war or you were going to face imminent death, that you could tell a close friend or a brother to take care of your mother. And that's exactly what happened. John then took care of Mary from that point on. And around the ninth hour, Jesus shouted a loud voice. And before I read to you this familiar phrase, I want you to realize what had happened here. In Gethsemane, part of the sins of the world had been settled upon him. But now he was becoming the Lamb. A short distance away in the courtyard of the temple, 256,000 lambs were being slain and the blood processed to absolve the sins of those who would partake of that supper. While those 256,000 lambs were symbolically being slain for the sins of those people, the real Lamb of God was hanging on the cross. And the sins of those people and all peoples before and since were being settled upon him. And where sin is, the Father cannot be. And so for the first time in this being's existence, the Father withdrew from him to let the rest of the sins of the world settle upon him where he could hold them by himself. The Father could not be there. And so he withdrew, I'm sure, to some corner of the universe to weep. And in that instant, Jesus said, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is, my God, why have you forsaken me? I don't feel you right now. Where did you go? And when the process was finished, he said, I thirst. Now, one of the things that the Roman guards allow the women to do is to take a reed with a sponge on the end of it and dip it into a drug made of vinegar and a kind of sleeping drug, a kind of morphine, kills the pain. And you can dip this sponge and you can wet the lips of the person up there. And what happens is they stop feeling the pain. The acroplasia goes away and you just settle into it. And it speeds along the suffocation. Jesus smelled the drug on the sponge and refused to take it. While he was hanging there, alive, holding the sins of the world, and the lambs were being slaughtered in the temple, he was being slaughtered on the cross. He then realized he had it. He was the Christ, and he said, it is finished. And then he said in a loud and firm voice, which actually surprised the guards and everyone around him, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And he left. What a lot of people don't know is right after this happened, it's getting on up to the hour that is going to begin the Sabbath. This is Friday, remember. Saturday is the Sabbath. At 6 p.m., the Sabbath begins. Well, it's against Jewish tradition to allow people to die on the Sabbath on the cross. And so there's a team that comes along with a cudgel. A cudgel is a long sledgehammer. And what they do is they swing the cudgel and they break the femurs of the person hanging on the cross. With that bone broken, it's impossible to push yourself up to catch a breath. And you die in just a few seconds. But when they arrived to Jesus, he was already gone. And so they did not break his bone with the cudgel. Can you imagine having that job? So they took him down and put him in the tomb. Saturday, he laid there And Sunday, he rose. He returned to his body perfected and left the tomb. Now, interestingly enough, he did not return to his father. That wasn't the first thing on his mind, not at all. The first thing on his mind was to see his Mary. And she came, and he spoke to her, because she was crying and wondering where he was, because his tomb was empty. Seeing him, no guards, him, she said, basically, what have you done with him? Where is he? She did not recognize him. He simply asked, woman, why weepest thou? And I can just imagine just pouring her heart out in anguish. And then he said one word that she recognized. Mary. And when he said that, she recognized him. And she went to hug him, as she had done her whole time knowing him. And he said, touch me not, for I have not yet ascended unto my Father, which is in heaven. So go tell the others that I am back and I will come and see them. And then he went to his Father. Now, we don't have enough time to go into the rest of the mission that he might have done while he was gone those 3 days, or who he visited. But I can tell you that time doesn't mean anything when you're not in the body. You can go anywhere you want, as long as you want, in that instant of time, and possibly he did. But the most important thing on his mind, in his soul, was to see her. I will tell you that that moment, the discovery of that, the visualization of that, the dreaming about that, taught me what love means. That's the love of a God. So as you consider Easter and you consider what it means, the interrelationship between God and man, Father and his children, I want you to consider that. Consider that care. It is perhaps not the overseeing Lord that we should fear, but an overreaching Lord that we should love, because that power of love is over everything and will overcome all. And so when people describe you as a God-fearing man, think about what that means. And maybe respond, a God-fearing woman, and respond and say, maybe. But I do know this. I'm a God-loving man. You are a God-loving woman. It's a big difference in how you face the day. With fear or with love. Be sure to look for the good in others and help it to grow a little bit every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. That's why you're here. That's why you're listening to this program. We'll see you next week, right here on X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew. Good night.